Welcome back to Space Castle. It's your clubhouse and ours for all things nerdy. My name is Alex.
My name is DT.
And I'm Seth.
This one's been teed up since we've all seen this movie. I put it out there and immediately it was like, okay, that's what we're doing this time. This is what we're talking about. I want to talk about the latest summer blockbuster sensation, Everything Everywhere All at Once.
Fuck yes. Finally. Thought you'd never ask.
Everything Everywhere All at Once, baby. God, what a flick.
Yeah. I have a feeling that I know a lot of the things that we're going to say about this movie in terms of praise and how awesome it was and how unexpectedly amazing it was. But I know that you guys have insightful things to say about this because you're the ones that were like, what are you doing? Watch this. And I think at one point I put in our Discord a trailer. I was like, this looks crazy. A24. Wow. Amazing. So cool. And then I forgot about it completely. And then out of nowhere, the movie had been released. I had no idea. And then both of you, like, individually, like, have you seen the movie yet? Go and watch it. What are you doing? So tell me your thoughts.
You summed it up in two sentences, man. This movie's amazing. Go watch it.
I hated it. That's what the people are expecting me to say. No, actually, I fucking adore this movie. I don't know if I'm just getting older.
Well, definitely that.
Or it's the times we live in, but this fucking movie made me cry like six fucking times. It's masterful. It's gorgeous. It's amazing. It's been a very, very long time since me, who's sort of a very cynical movie watcher at this point, apparently, allegedly, by reputation.
The stats don't lie, friend.
Can say that a movie I've seen one time has literally become one of my favorite movies of all time instantly. It's been a long time since I've been able to say that. This movie is just fucking incredible.
I think I was the first of our trio to see the movie, and I remember watching it maybe a third of the way through. I was like, oh my God, it's super weird to be amidst the first watching of one of my favorite movies of all time.
Totally.
Like, I realized it very early in the runtime. I was like, this is going to be one of my favorite movies. Like,
while you're in it. Yeah.
And I had this like weird out of body experience where I was like, normally you don't get to experience that, right? Where you're like, you wish you could go back and experience your favorite things for the first time all over again or whatever, right? I had that during this. And I was like, this is it. Like, I am currently experiencing my favorite thing for the first time. Like, this is super weird.
Yeah.
I remember watching the trailer, and the reason I was hyped about it originally was like, wow, this looks amazing. It looks really out of left field, but also kind of cool way to approach multiverse. But then I remember when you guys were finally like, why are you wasting your time going to watch this movie? And I sat down, I was like, I'm going to live tweet this. I'm going to be on the Discord. I'm going to be like live tweeting. And then I couldn't. I like got through. Like,
I remember that.
I think a couple times I dropped a line or two and I was like, I have to watch this movie. I have to like be in it.
It's wholly engrossing. Yeah.
For those that don't know, somehow, I don't do trailers or basically anything. I get to a point where like I know about a thing and that's it. Like, if I decide I want to watch a movie, once I know of that movie's existence, I am done with it until I see it at runtime. So I didn't know that this was about multiverse stuff. I didn't know anything about it. All I knew was Michelle Yeoh's in a new movie, and it's called Everything Everywhere All at Once, which is a phenomenal title. And I was like, that's it. Like, those two things together, I'm in. So I had no idea what this movie was about, who else was in it, like nothing. Going in, and I was utterly surprised the entire time. The whole thing is great. And I didn't realize that fucking Ke-Huy Quan, the guy who does Short Round, I did not realize until the elevator scene that was who that was.
Yeah. Ke-Huy Quan is how he pronounces it, but yeah.
Got it.
It's a tricky one. It's Vietnamese, I believe.
So. I mean, it's like reading, you know, iguana or something. That's not how reading it only, not hearing it is not really good for pronunciation.
Yeah.
It was like revelatory when he started using the fanny pack as a weapon, spoiler alert. I was like, hey, wait a minute. Like, his body language seems extremely familiar and I think I recognize him, but I didn't realize that it can't be. No, it can't be. And then I looked it up afterwards and I was like, fuck, man. I can't believe that that's who that is. After like fucking 30 years of not acting.
Seriously.
Where has he been this whole time? It's fucking excellent.
Yeah, that's one of my biggest takeaways from this movie. And there's a ton of fucking takeaways. And we'll get into probably all of them. But Ke-Huy Quan, he hasn't been around. We haven't seen the man in 30 years. Like, the last time we saw him was like Encino Man, where he had like a walk-on role because he's friends with Sean Astin because of the whole Goonies connection.
Yeah.
And he bowed out of acting because there just weren't any opportunities for him as an Asian actor and a former child star who did Goonies and Indiana Jones. So instead, he started doing stunt coordination. I bet he had a lot to do with the stunts and the fight coordination in this movie, too.
Absolutely.
And he did a bunch of like second unit directing and stuff just to stay in the industry because he wanted to be a part of it. But because Hollywood had its collective head up its ass for so long, I feel like we've been fucking robbed of 30 years of amazing performances from this man. And that's a fucking shame.
It's a travesty.
Because he and Michelle Yeoh worked together to be the heart of this movie. And he is so fucking good that it's like, yeah, I remember the guy from 30 years ago, but it's also like a brand new revelation that like, holy shit, this dude's a fucking actor, man. Like, he's amazing in this movie.
Absolutely killed it. I'm really, really glad to see that the cast is primarily Asian too, which was so good. Everything about it feels like, for so long, I have felt that like a lot of movie studios, whenever they're presented with a decision, a fork in the road, they always choose the wrong fucking decision. And this movie felt like a collection of the right decisions every time.
That's also kind of meta because this movie is all about making decisions and how decisions shape our lives.
I'm a professional, DT.
Yeah. And like, I mean, the basis for this movie is that every decision we make in our lives creates a new branch in the multiverse. And that's how do we get into the plot of this fucking thing? Because it's hard to describe it on paper.
Hey, guess what? We're in it, bitch. The plot of this.
Michelle Yeoh plays Evelyn, who is this woman who is not having a great time. Like, she's about to divorce her husband. The laundry shop that she runs with her husband is being audited by the IRS. She's on the outs of her relationship with her daughter because she's just... it's hard for me to talk about this movie being a white guy, but as I understand it, from everything that my Asian friends have told me, this is a very Asian story about Asian parents and how to cope with that and the relationship that Asian parents sometimes fall into with their kids because they want the best for them, but they end up being too strict and driving their kids away as a result. I'm not going to get too much into that, like I said, because I'm a white guy. I have no frame of reference for that. But what happens in this movie is we learned that there's an Alphaverse, like the one universe that started everything. And the decisions that Evelyn made while she was that Alpha Evelyn drove her daughter Joy to become just disconnected. Just
broke her brain.
Emotionally distraught and just ruined her, basically. And she becomes this all-knowing, all-seeing, experiencing the multiverse at all times, all at once, godlike figure who has decided that nothing fucking matters anymore. Fuck everything. I'm going to create this object that's going to destroy the universe. And our Evelyn that we're introduced to in this movie, because she's made all the wrong decisions, she ends up being the one person who could stop her alpha version of her daughter from destroying the universe. And she does so by becoming a good person and making the right decisions and changing the course of her life, which empowers her to change the course of her multiverse daughter's life as well. It's an amazingly beautiful story about how every single choice you make has consequences, and you can always go back and correct those choices and make things better retroactively by becoming a good person and being a good person to the people you love, and you can help the people that you love become better people too. I'm simplifying it because this movie is fucking wild. It's buck-ass wild, and it's insane, and it shouldn't work. But everything works fucking beautifully. And it's insane to me that this is the Daniels' second theatrical release ever besides Swiss Army Man, because the mastery of storytelling and visual storytelling here is just other fucking worldly. It's nuts.
Yeah, DT mentioned the Daniels. Those are the directors of this film, Daniel Kwan and Daniel Scheinert. Am I saying that right?
Mm-hmm.
I think what's wild to me is the characters in this to like frame it. And DT, I think you did a really good job of explaining the movie in a nutshell, which is really difficult to do.
It's a very complicated movie.
I'm a professional.
You're a professional. Yeah, you're right. It is very much an Asian story from everything that I've heard. And it's also, from what I understand, a really good representation of queer relationships with parents. Like not relationships necessarily, but how that works in a family dynamic. As a straight guy, it's very eye-opening, honestly, to kind of like try to put yourself in the shoes of somebody that's in that situation. It was really heart-wrenching in moments and kind of like really eye-opening. But what I was going to talk about with the characters, though, is that you often in movies like this get these very trope-ridden sort of single-dimension characters that are representations of like one action or thing that they are going to try to force in the plot. But they each of these characters kind of represents a different idea, which is wild. Like you have James Hong's character, like the father, who's very much like the traditional Asian parents. And then you have Evelyn's character, I think, is so fascinating as a protagonist because of her failing at every turn, she has the most room to grow. So it's a very interesting character to watch play throughout this entire thing.
Mm-hmm.
Like immediately she starts to solve her problem, and in a quintessential main character way, she starts solving it in the worst way possible. It's like, okay, what do we do? Well, Alpha Wayman is telling her, well, we need to make sure that you don't die, so like let's learn how to fight so you can protect yourself. But then after that, she's like, okay, what other cool things can I learn? But it's not until she embraces the like weirdness of the entire situation and the wackiness of life that she actually makes good progress and starts to open her mind to what her daughter's been experiencing. And then Jobu Tupaki has essentially like run away, like try to solve your own problem in 100 different ways and then just throw your hands up and say, I don't really know what to do anymore.
Yeah.
And that's a fascinating antagonist. Pitting those two against each other is just an amazing kind of backdrop for a movie that feels like a big budget student film, just like done so, so well.
I don't know if I would call it that. It's way too masterful and too well controlled, despite the fact that the movie is very chaotic. It doesn't feel like a student film to me. It feels like, I don't know. It's weird to say that this is the second like theatrical feature these two guys have produced and put out there, because it feels so well made. But at the same time, I guess you are right that it does still feel early in their careers. And I'm wildly fucking excited to see what the Daniels do from here and where they go.
To clarify, I don't think that it has that skill level. Like student films, when people hear that, they think like, oh, it's just amateurish. And I don't think that at all. This is, like you said, it's masterful. Like it was made with a $25 million budget. And it quadrupled that in the box office already. It came out 3.5 months ago. So like they've obviously done something very well. There are articles galore online saying best movie of the summer, best movie that we have so far this year, shoe in for best picture nod, like amazing film.
It better fucking be. If this movie isn't nominated for everything, I'm officially, like, no joke, done with the Oscars. Like, if Michelle Yeoh does not win Best Actress for this movie, it's a fucking farce. It's a sham. It is. She's phenomenal in this movie. And it's wild to think that it was originally written for Jackie Chan, but they made the smart decision to rewrite the script for a woman, and they got Michelle Yeoh on board. And I cannot imagine this movie without Michelle Yeoh as the heart of it. She just absolutely fucking kills in it.
Mm-hmm.
I think casting Jackie Chan also kind of comes with its own baggage. You immediately tie his character and his like presence there with his other films and sort of his very storied career. Not to say that Michelle Yeoh doesn't have that, but the cast in this alone is just phenomenal. It's amazing. I've already mentioned James Hong, Jamie Lee Curtis, Harry Shum Jr. Out of nowhere, all of these big time actors like show up and do amazing things. They're really cool behind the scenes things with the Daniels online that you can watch, sort of like scene breakdowns. They did one with Michelle Yeoh kind of talking about the scene where Jamie Lee Curtis is like flying in with her knee to demolish him in a staircase.
Oh, God, I love that fucking shot, too.
It's so cool to hear them talk about it. And that's why I kind of made that student film reference, because they talk about their filmmaking in that way. That's like very much, let's make everything as practical as we can, put them on wires, make a traditional like kung fu style movie where we're just going to have the actual actors like flying through the frame and then light it and then mask out the lines. And that's what you get.
Yeah.
Which is just amazing.
Yeah. Like if Marvel had made this movie, everything would be fucking green screen. There wouldn't even be a staircase. It'd be a CGI model of Jamie Lee Curtis. And there's a time and place for all of that. But the practicality of this movie lends itself to the story they're trying to tell. And because it's such a big and giant and grand and crazy and absurd story, it also makes it feel, the fact that it's so practically made also makes it feel quaint in a really warm and inviting way, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
It's just fucking great. Like, I love the feel of this movie as much as I love the performances and the plot and the message. The feel of this movie is just excellent. It's just warm. I love it. It feels alive.
I think a lot of that has to do with it. It doesn't take itself too seriously. In an age where multiverse is like, oh, let's explore the ramifications of this physically. This is a movie that's like, let me explore that philosophically. And then also address the just sheer insanity that would come from actual multiverse. And let's come up with the most wacky situations. All right, Evelyn is a sign spinner. How does that play in? Can she use that? Yes, here's a riot shield. What are you going to do with this?
Yeah.
Like, that's amazing. Hot dog fingers. Like, what? No, that was it. Just like,
yeah, hot dog fingers was just, what the fuck is this movie? This is magical. It just, yeah. And it's absurd, but it doesn't feel like it's trying to be absurd. It just is. Like, everything in this movie is just displayed matter-of-factly. And I love the device of having to make a crazy split decision and do something completely out of character for yourself in order to link yourself to the multiverse version of yourself that has the skills you need for that situation. Evelyn having to battle with guards and get out of a smoke-filled room with tear gas. She has to do something absurd in order to tap into a multiverse version of herself that is blind so that she can get through that fight and know how to fight these guys without being able to see. And so the movie opens up this wild, like, just list of scenarios that happen because these characters have to do something absolutely fucking bonkers and out of character for themselves and absurd to break through that wall to be able to physically connect with their multiverse version that has the skills they need. And it's just, I don't know how they came up with this shit, but it's just fucking, it's brilliant.
Everybody has their rules that they have to abide by when they're making a movie, and these guys were just like, nope, I don't care. They're going to make references to classics like Kill Bill, Ratatouille. They're like other the raccoon. Oh, my goodness. But it's all practical.
Raccoon Cooney was like one of those moments where I couldn't stop laughing and thinking, like, how did this movie get made? Like, these guys, the Daniels, are just fucking rock stars, man. Like, holy shit.
Joy's character beats guards up by turning them into confetti and beating them with dildos, like,
right?
I don't understand what
the surrealist masterpiece is, what this film is. That speaks volumes to the level of control that the Daniels have with their own vision and their filmmaking. You can tell that every decision in this movie was considered. There was a decision made for everything, and that's what takes it out of absurdism and into surrealism. And that transition is profound, I think.
Mm-hmm.
The level of decision making that was made on set for every prop, for the micro actions of each person, that is why I think I like Michelle Yeoh and Stephanie Hsu.
Yeah.
That's why I like them in particular, is because they're very, very good at conveying micro expressions with their face. And this movie needs that, because the level of confidence in every micro decision that's made is what keeps it in surrealist territory and out of absurdism. And being in the surrealist area is what allows the audience member to believe that the philosophical arguments and discussion that's being had in this film is real and is worthy of their respect. If you didn't have that level of surrealist and it was just absurd bullshit, you wouldn't be able to talk with any authority about the philosophical implications of this film in the film. The audience wouldn't buy into that. You wouldn't be able to have those really deep, profound discussions that this film does, because the audience wouldn't be on board. They wouldn't believe it.
I like what you said about the micro expressions. There's a featurette that the Daniels talk about this, where it's Evelyn and Alpha Waymond are talking, and there's like a barrier between the two of them, and you can only see their eyes. And they talked about how, like, in a traditional set, you'd just get them some apple boxes, they'd stand on them, and they'd be able to look at each other in the faces. But these two actors could so effectively communicate and act with just their eyes that it was just this powerful scene that happened between the two of them, where they're communicating everything they need to, a la Inverse Batman right now, just there with their expressions of their eyebrows and their eyes, and which is just amazing. But many times while I was watching the like transition scenes in this, I was thinking, like, whoa, this is very Edgar Wright. You know, it's very much like they get smacked in one universe, and then she whips her head around and is into another universe, and the dialogue transitions with her, which is wild. So like her conversation in one universe completely carries over and makes sense in the context of a completely different conversation, which is like a very nuanced and funny and subtle way to tie the universes together without making it like, oh, now I'm in a completely fish out of water new environment. No, you're kind of in like a, you're on a tangent. You're connected, but you're on a tangent, which is just phenomenal.
This movie is an absolute masterpiece.
It really fucking is. All three of us have said before, it's wild to just, especially in this day and age where everything is so mass produced and cynical and corporate, to say that, you know, the movie you're watching right at that moment is going to be one of your favorite movies. And for me, that's really tough because all my favorite movies are probably 30 years old or older than that. And it's fucking incredible that the Daniels were able to put this thing together and make just such a masterful movie that touched my cynical, cold, icy heart and melted it.
I think this movie is not only the type of filmmaking that I want to see more of, which I think is obvious. I can probably speak for the three of us when I say that. We want to see more of this type of filmmaking. This movie is such that you couldn't have just thrown money at it to fix a problem. That's not how this would have worked. And because of that, it's charming and lovely and all of that. But you can tell that they spent time. You can't buy time, but they spent time here to make sure that not only was this a good story, but they had something to say specifically. They weren't just making a movie because they could or because they thought it'd be fun to try out some new special effects or whatever. They had something specific to say, and they said it. And they weren't going to water it down for certain audiences. They had a thing to say, and they said that thing, which I think is why, Alex, why you feel like it's more of like student film-esque, because that's a lot of how those tend to go, is they don't take studios' decisions into consideration. And Everything Everywhere All at Once also didn't take a lot of that into consideration. They just made the movie they wanted to. And what is so spectacular about it is, and you can tell on first viewing, that this is a movie that will hold up to scrutiny. You can watch it a dozen times. You can watch it at a quarter speed. It doesn't matter. The decisions are such that you can investigate every scene, every prop decision, to like basically any level of scrutiny, and it all holds up within its own context. And that's rare even in big budget movies.
Thank goodness for A24 for being that studio.
Yes.
No shit.
Just being that bastion of creative filmmaking in Hollywood right now, where they allow people like the Daniels to just make whatever the fuck they want. Because when you allow really talented, really creative filmmakers to do whatever the fuck they want, like, chances are you're going to end up with something amazing like this, and not something that feels mass-produced and neatly packaged for mass audiences. And I am so fucking thrilled that people are embracing this movie, too. I mean, like what Alex said before, it's made back its budget threefold. Like, it's A24's highest-grossing movie to date. Like, it surpassed Hereditary, which was their biggest hit by far. And it's so wonderful to see a studio say, yeah, go make this crazy fucking movie. These two guys go out and make this fucking movie with seemingly like no restrictions on what they were going to do. And to see audiences be like, we're fucking fully on board for this. We want more of this. It's wonderful.
Yeah, it gives me hope.
I was getting to the point, honestly, where I was thinking shit like this wasn't possible anymore. And the fact that everybody who collaborated on this project and made this succeed, made it succeed, gives me hope as a movie fan. Mm-hmm. Which I know sounds overly like dramatic and cheesy, but we live in an age of, you know, slapdash Star Wars movies and Marvel movies that come out 4 or 5 times a year. And it feels like all the smaller independent art films are getting drowned out. And to see one like this, like, break through that barrier and through that glass ceiling and succeed the way it has, is just, it's just fucking great as a fan of film.
Mm-hmm. It really does give you hope that we'll get good, careful, intentional films again.
Intentional is a great fucking word, man.
This is an extremely intentional film. And we've said that with different words this whole time, basically. This movie is weird and wacky and slow and fast and big and quiet and absolutely delightful.
And also heartbreaking.
It's heartbreaking and heartwarming. We didn't even talk about the rock scene. Like I cried several times.
Yep.
Which is not unheard of in films for me, but this movie hits different, like straight up.
Yeah, when you can elicit an emotional response when having just like googly eyes on two rocks fall down a cliff, like what? You're doing something right.
You have text on screen and two rocks with googly eyes poised above a cliff, and that's it. There's no action happening, and I cry. Like, yeah, okay, you did it. Congratulations, you made it.
Yep.
there are a lot of things that I want to see continue on and see more of in Hollywood that this movie brings, and like director duos that are doing it right that we're not seeing in like big blockbuster films. It's rare for a director duo, I think, to work well and not step on each other's toes creatively.
Mm-hmm.
And these guys seem to have accomplished that very well. Goodness as a message, and especially in a film that is martial arts heavy. Michelle Yeoh gets to the end, and Evelyn, instead of beating the shit out of everybody to get to the solution in the end, the resolution in the end, she uses her powers to literally just like stitch together everybody's problems and make things right.
Yeah.
And so in order to get to the point where she can even conceive of trying to reconcile her relationship with her daughter and have that difficult conversation, which is one of my favorite parts of the story as a whole, is that at the very end, the final boss battle is a conversation.
Yeah.
Like she has to have a conversation with her daughter, which is amazing. And she ultimately doesn't relent. She doesn't say, I was wrong and you were right and please forgive me. It's like, this is who I am.
Yeah. We both have fucked up and that's okay.
Yeah. And we still love each other.
Well, what's tough is she's like, if you need to get away from me to be happy and be a better person, be the person you want to be, then do it. But then she's like, no, that's not the solution either. The solution is for me to be better and be better for you.
Mm-hmm.
I'm tearing up again just fucking thinking about that scene in that parking lot, man. It's
good, dude. That parking lot scene is so good. For me, that's what solidifies the entire idea of this movie. Is like they didn't drop the ball at the end. They didn't fumble it right at the finish line, which would have been so easy because this is like the most precarious finale, right? It's like it's just a kind of bad mother and her estranged, stressed out, broken daughter that they have to talk it out and reconcile and come to some kind of agreement. And what I love so much is that Evelyn is like, there, like you said, Alex, there's no relenting there. She didn't just give him, be like, I will change all my stuff so that I can keep in touch with my daughter. It wasn't like that. She was like, hey, like, I'm going to try to be better and stitch this together, but you also need to help try and do that. Like, you were put in this situation and you handled it poorly as well. And we need, both of us need to find a compromise in this relationship so that we can both be happy together again.
Yeah.
And that's so great.
Yeah, and it addresses solving problems in a way that's not just like ham-fisted and bull-rushing them and addressing them in the most immediate way possible. And that happens through the character interactions, like even with Deirdre, right? When she understands and they kind of have a conversation about what's really happening and not try to like do their job or on Deirdre's side or like circumvent the IRS on Evelyn's side, it's they end up talking about the thing that connects them, which is this like tragic situation that they've both experienced in divorce. And that's just like with a minor character, right? Then you have the entire conversation that happens with Joy, which is, you know, the culmination, sort of the reason for this film and thematically ties everything together. But then, you know, that staircase scene in the end, the climax of the actual like action of the film is what tied it all together. I think outside of the emotional arc, the physical arc, she doesn't just beat everybody to death. Like she's making intentional action to do the right thing and the good thing instead of just using her ability. She ostensibly could have just like plowed her way through all of them to get to Joy at the end and instead took the time to, being that she had the ability to, solve all of these people's problems and learn from those things.
Yes. The culmination of the character becoming the true hero is not the ability to kick everybody's ass. It's the ability to reach into people and draw the good out of them and help them fix their problems. Fucking A, Daniels. Holy shit.
This is a profoundly human movie. And I love that a lot because it takes this surrealist bullshit and is like, hey, our minds are all fucking wild and nobody knows what's going on. the best you can do is try to figure it out and try to make good on these things and try to do better. The movie is just showing that on the screen, but we all have fucking wild bullshit going on in our heads. And this movie just shows that. And it's like, hey, if you're also having wild bullshit going on, look, here's an example of like trying to make it better.
Yeah. How does your brain address like true hardship and problems in your life? This surrealism is a really awesome medium to address the complete and utter chaos that is our like mental landscape. Yeah.
It's a great fucking movie, man. Straight up. Honestly, it has like 96% on Rotten Tomatoes, and I feel like that's a little low.
It should be 100. Let's yeah. make it a fucking 100. Let's get Space Castle as like a valid source of reviews for Rotten Tomatoes. Let's bump that fucking number up somehow. I absolutely adore this movie. This movie shot up to my top 10, which is fucking insane. I absolutely fucking adore this movie. I cannot wait to see what the Daniels do next. I can't wait to see what Michelle Yeoh does next. I hope this revitalizes his career the same way Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon did. Because, again, that's somebody we haven't seen enough of in the last, like, 20 years. And she's wonderful.
I saw Crouching Tiger and was like, oh, shit, I think I really like Michelle Yeoh. And I've basically just religiously watched everything that she's been in since. Mm-hmm. And it has not let me down once. So, like I said, all I needed to see this movie was this dope-ass name, which is excellent, and the fact that Michelle Yeoh's in it. And that was it. I'm on board. And I will be in the future.
Go watch the feature ads, too. They're amazing. To hear just the Daniels break down their processes, like watching her verse jump, there's a breakdown of that, which is amazing, where they talk about, instead of getting like the big proper studio green screens on either side of her, they just like had light-up LED panels that they programmed to have footage that Daniel Kwan just took off of like a little 360 camera walking through downtown areas.
Yeah, perfect.
And they sped it up and then just laid that on LEDs. And so it's very much like, I don't want to say it disparagingly, they approached it like a student film in that anything was available. Anything could happen. And it's amazing.
This movie is also, we didn't really touch on it, is a technical spectacle. Like they did really, really great effects and just technique work, which we didn't touch on, but it's fucking phenomenal. Yeah, this movie is great in every aspect, no matter which way you look at it.
We've talked about this once or twice before on the podcast, I think, where minimalism and limited resources breed a high level of creativity. And this movie was made for what's essentially a shoestring budget for what it is. But what they achieved here and the level of special effects, the fidelity, the acting, the writing, everything here is just incredible. And it's very much with like Jack White, who's one of my favorite musicians, his philosophy is that if you have limited resources and you're struggling with what you've got to put out the highest level of creative output you can, chances are that product is going to be better. We've been seeing the praises of this movie this whole time, and it's because of the fact that these guys did things the way they wanted to do them. They didn't do it the Marvel or Disney way with, you know, fuck it, we'll CGI later. We'll essentially rewrite the movie again after we've shot it. We'll just use CGI to fix what we want to do. It's that handmade love and care aspect of this movie that I think really just sells it and just brings it home as this awesome package. And I think that's why the actors are so heavily invested in it too, because they are reacting to actual fucking things that are there on the set. They are working with directors who understand the human experience and are able to convey the message they want to convey, whether it's abstract in very much the way this movie does so, or in plain terms where it's just two characters who are embodying rocks having an honest conversation with each other.
Absolutely. And I think it also makes you address that escapism isn't always going to like get you away from your problems, which is a really difficult thing to stomach.
Mm-hmm.
So it takes this fantasy that a lot of people might have of escaping reality and escaping your problems and then puts it right back in front of you. Like one of the more profound scenes in the movie to me outside of all the interactions with Joy's character is when she's talking to Wayman in the universe where she's mega successful and she doesn't have that relationship.
Yeah, the movie star one.
Yeah, when she's a movie star and has been kicking ass and taking names. And ultimately, they can't figure it out. And it hurts. It hurts so good.
Yeah.
You have the ability to find all of these different versions of yourself where things could potentially be better, right? And ultimately, the root of your problems is still going to be there if you're not willing to sort of make change yourself.
This is a movie that makes you really think about and consider your life choices. And choices that you made yourself that may have hurt you may have ended up having a profound impact on somebody else and made their life better. This movie just makes you think and it sticks with you forever. Go fucking watch it. Go and think about your life. And then when you're done watching it, text your parents and tell them you love them. Okay?
This movie's fucking good.
I think Goldblum's crying in a corner right now.
I think we've emotionally broken Goldblum. Even his cold, hard AI mind has been touched by the profundity of this movie. So thank you for letting us finish. We love you too.
Well, if he tries to verse jump, it's going to be pretty difficult to tell because he does all that wacky stuff anyway. So
he's got like a whole internet he can jump into and out of as well. So that's pretty much a multiverse into an itself.
In and of itself, yeah.
Maybe that's why he's having such a hard time. Maybe I should limit Goldblum's internet access.
At least cut him off from Reddit.
Probably a lot of corners of the internet I should cut him off from, to be honest with you.
In the meantime, though, we've got messages from Earth we've got to get to. Once we're done with those, we've got a Deep Space Recon and an awesome question we're going to answer definitively once and for all because we're professionals.
Yay!
Yeah.
Hi, I'm Kay.
And I'm Jay. And we give you the Fuck My Work Life podcast.
The weekly podcast where we read your workplace stories to you. Hilarious mishaps.
I lost my balance and grabbed the only thing I could to steady myself. I grabbed the teetering stack of about 8 sheets of drywall. I hit all of my knees and elbows on the way down.
all of them.
Workplace shenanigans.
Carl and Ted had super glued all Bob's pencils and pens to his desk.
Full disclosure, I smoked a lot of weed at that time.
Awkward encounters.
As he's wandering around the party girl section
exactly.
of a clothing store.
Follow us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and TikTok at FMWLPOD. That's FMWL Pod.
Email your stories to FMWLPOD@gmail.com. That's FMWLPOD@gmail.com.
As always, those were some great messages from Earth, and I'm pretty sure in one of the multiverses, there's a DT that just doesn't make any gross, terrible seg jokes.
That is not this one.
It's not this universe. No. Alex asked me if I would be willing to seg him, and yeah, I'm always willing to seg you, Alex. I'm always willing to throw you one when you need it.
Oh, Jesus Christ.
It gets worse every time.
I didn't realize that we were in the universe where this is all the incorrect decisions.
Oh, I did.
Yeah, I didn't know that, actually, now that I'm thinking about it.
This is by far the darkest fucking timeline. Yeah. One of us is, unbeknownst to ourselves, preparing to be the savior of the universe because we've all made the worst possible decisions. Someone in this universe, this world, for sure.
Well, I've got to be the, like, weird minor character that gets in the way. That would probably be my role. So it's got to be one of the two of you.
You're the Jamie Lee Curtis to our Michelle Yeoh.
Yeah, ultimately, you learn good lessons from me, but, I'm not going to work for the IRS. Anyway, it's funny that you mentioned Goldblum having access to the internet, because I was kind of thinking about resources that we all have. We've done a Deep Space on Project Hail Mary before, mm-hmm. and in that, the main character, he's got access to basically the entirety of human knowledge in the form of digital resources. So he's got like PDFs, he's got Wikipedia, whatever. There are people online now that sell little Raspberry Pis that just have the entirety of whatever we can figure out and put on small storage. And you can get Wikipedia, you can get like the collective medical journals that are a common source, like everything that we can put on a little tiny like hard drive. But it got me thinking about writing resources because, that's what I like to talk about in Deep Space is writing in books. And one of my favorites that I've run across in the last like decade has been one of the most successful authors right now in the fantasy space is Brandon Sanderson.
Brando Sando.
He is the most successful Kickstarter ever. And he also is a guest lecturer. The guy is literally a machine. He writes books like nonstop. He talks about writing in his downtime when he's not writing. He's writing about writing. And he's lecturing at BYU. And his lectures are available online for free.
No shit.
They used to be on a YouTube channel called like Camera Panda or something like that, but they're now on his official YouTube channel. He's got going on 500,000 subscribers already, and it's not been up for that long. But you can watch his entire lecture series. I'm all about these things. Like, I'm so interested in Masterclass. I haven't signed up. My career has been informed by Udemy and learning how to do ads from that. And I think there are just so many online resources that are important and helpful. And this is one that you don't have to pay for. Like, you can go, like Harvard just released CS50 and the intro to just like programming. You can go and get a Ivy League education introductory class for free. But this Brandon Sanderson lecture is specific to writing and the creative process. And he talks about world building, character building, how plot, conflict, and setting all interact, or rather plot, character, and setting all interact via conflict. And he also talks about the traditional publishing sort of track and self-publishing also. So we'll have guest lecturers sometimes come in, like an agent or an editor or a fellow author will come in and give different guest lectures. But ultimately, he just sometimes does Q&As and answers questions from the audience and uses references to familiar IP like Star Wars that we all know and love as a way to kind of understand writing and the craft of writing and kind of how to get your story onto paper, which is amazing.
Fucking hey, and good on him for throwing it out there as a resource for free. That's awesome.
For free. Yep. It's amazing.
Free knowledge. Let's have more of that, please. Let's not fucking paywall everything.
Hell yeah.
It's cool too, because like you'd think like, well, why would I ever take the class or whatever? But they have the ability to do their like little writing groups, and their kind of editorial feedback is the main benefit there. But you can get all of the other bits online for free, which is amazing. So yeah, check it out.
I've gone through the whole lecture series myself as well, and it is phenomenal. It's good information, even if you're not trying to write a novel. Like if you're just doing some other creative endeavor, there's a lot of good info about like what makes characters worthwhile and how to do good world building and stuff like that. It is aimed at novels, but even if you're not writing a novel, there is still lots to take away from. For a little bit of clarification, these are like filmed classroom lectures. So like there's like a class full of students and he's giving a lecture to the students, but it's also being filmed from the back, basically.
Yeah, it's like a proper like lecture hall environment. They used to film them on smartphones years back, and the potato quality has since been replaced by a proper multicam setup.
Dope. Sweet, man. Thanks for sharing. That's fantastic.
For sure.
Check it out for sure. Yeah.
You just look up creative writing lecture Brandon Sanderson and you'll find it. It's there on the Googles, on the YouTubes.
Seth, you've been waiting this whole fucking time to present this question to us. I know.
I'm worried.
As soon as I saw Alex winding down his deep space, I saw the edges of your mouth curl up into like a Grinchish smile. I can't wait. I'm nervous. Just throw it out there. Hit us with this shit.
This listener question is not a listener question this week. It is just from my brain because I thought about it at some point like a week and a half ago, and I literally have not stopped considering it since then. I'm bringing it to you folks. So hopefully I can get some answers and closure and get this shit out of my head.
Well, we are professionals.
Okay. In the theme of surrealism,
uh-oh,
it's a little bit of a carryover. I had a thought, and I promise I don't always think about centaurs.
Oh, no.
But this one also has to do with centaurs. I'm sorry. When centaurs are running, what do they do with their hands? Do they run a lot? Like, are they waving their hands?
Right.
Are they just holding them on their chest? Is this why we always see centaurs with bows and arrows, so that they have something to do with their hands while they're galloping?
It's a good question.
What do they do? Because they don't, there's no way they pump their arms, right? There's no fucking way.
No, I mean, we do it as humans to propel ourselves and like,
keep balance and momentum and stuff.
Right.
But like, there's no way, right?
From the kinesiology standpoint, I don't imagine there's any function that's developed, because we pump our arms to help with our like our hip movement and get our like our propulsion. Yeah.
Yeah. Keep our center of gravity rotating and stuff.
Right. And yeah, exactly. Stay on our feet. So,
there
must be a balance issue, right?
Well, but that brings the other thing. Horses just have a head. They're like, they don't need the balance correction, which brings me to the reason that this is still stuck in my head, which is, okay, so I think it's pretty safe to say they don't pump their arms when they gallop.
Okay, if they did, though, which set of legs would they pump their arms with? The back ones or the front ones?
It would be oscillating, for sure. It'd be, yeah, it'd be on the front ones. So I think it's, they probably don't, right? Which means there's two options. They either hold them up or they do like the Dougie.
They just let him fly.
Just let him flop around. Right?
It's a Weekend at Bernie's.
It's just, yeah, like.
Is the human half of the centaur the driver or the passenger or both?
No, it's all one body, man. You aren't the driver and passenger of your legs. Like, it's just one thing.
Sometimes I am. Depends on how drunk I am.
Fair. Yeah, but that's how it is for centaurs too. They're it's just one body. Both options, either pumping their arms or not, are fucking weird. And I can't stop thinking about them. And I need an answer.
What would you do? Would you just like, just fold your hands in front of you and just like trot along? Like
the queen?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know what the fuck. Or like hold him in like a perpetual action pose while you're running. I guess that's what I would do if I was a centaur. I would hold the arms up or hold them forward like I was flying. I don't know.
It's like when you're in a car and you pretend like you're sprinting and pump your arms really fast. You feel like you're going really quick.
Yeah, like fucking Dumb and Dumber. Yeah.
No, I see. This is why mini centaurs, if they're not, they don't have the bow and arrow. They've got a big spear because they're like those guys on a tightrope.
I think that's what it is. I think like filmmakers and artists are like, what the fuck do we do with the centaur's arms while it's running?
They got Ricky Bobby syndrome.
Yeah, we got to do something with them. I don't fucking bow and arrow or a shield and a sword or like Alex said, like a spear, because otherwise they would just like their arms would just be down at their sides and it'd be fucking running full fucking speed. Like
I think I've seen like a I think I've seen the human arms are like as if they're riding a horse, which is strange.
holding reins, invisible reins.
They're like, yeah, they're because that's what's your brain associates with it.
That's not the right answer, is it? That can't be.
It's not. But like imagine it, as if somebody was riding the horse portion of the centaur on their back and they just moved the human part up and attached it to the horse.
Wow, Alex, I didn't think I could hate this more, but I do. I hate that. Yeah. I hate that a lot. Mm-hmm. That's not a good idea. I don't like it.
Do you think there are any like kinky centaurs out there that like do like the whole horse and bridle thing?
DT,
I hope not.
Why? Why do you always take these turns?
I'm a professional.
Oh, man.
I think I have to just decide that they're doing the floppy arms Dougie thing. Just because I think it's funny.
I think it's Naruto run.
It's Naruto
oh
running.
Oh, my God. You're go. Right. That's what it is.
It's like head down, arms back.
Oh, my God. Alex, I think you cracked it, man.
You son of a bitch.
Yep. Hashtag we need more centaurs in anime. Which is a terrible, terrible hashtag.
Also the title of this episode.
We need more centaurs in anime.
Every centaur, every anime all at once.
We'll get there. Keep workshopping.
Did Alex answer your question sufficiently? I feel like he did.
I was getting distressed until the Naruto running thing, and I think that did it.
We went from bow and arrows to Weekend at Bernie's to Naruto running.
It felt like a natural progression. Yeah,
it works. Yeah.
Do you think that they pet themselves?
Oh, God.
How do they reach their tails to brush their tails? They'd have to do it for each other, right?
Yeah, It's like strongmans with their back scratching. Like someone else has to do it because they can't reach.
Okay, here's a question for you guys. When centaurs are in love and they share a bed, do they spoon somehow? Or do they have to lay like opposite, like two opposing L and J shapes and just like cuddle their human bodies?
They cuddle the exact same way that regular horses cuddle. The confusion on your face tells me you haven't seen pictures of that.
They mount each other?
What? Have you ever seen giraffes cuddle?
No. They twirl their necks around each other? I don't know.
Yeah, it's the same thing. They lay down like regular horses and giraffes, right? Where like vertically on their haunches, and then they like wrap their torsos together, like a giraffe would wrap its neck.
That's very scientific.
Yeah, I feel confident because that is a thing that actually happens. Now, the dead Bernie Naruto arms, I have no fucking idea. I feel confident in centaur cuddling that's how they would do it. They would do it like giraffes would.
When do I add amateur centaur biologist to my list of titles?
Right fucking now, guess what?
I don't think you're amateur at all. I think you're full on fucking professional, like master's degree.
Professional centaur biologist.
All right, we're doing it.
Happy early birthday.
All right.
Well, I feel good that we came to a conclusion. My brain is happy with that, I think.
I think we've contributed something to society with this episode of Space Castle. I think that's going to do it for this episode of Space Castle. As always, it's your clubhouse and ours for all things nerdy, as well as centaur anatomy. We want to thank our good friend Brian Lovett, a.k.a. B-Fuck Supreme, for helping us co-write our theme song, These Notes. Want to invite you guys to join our Patreon at patreon.com/spacecastlepod. Become part of the crew, get all kinds of cool extra bonus stuff and content. And leave a review for us on your favorite podcast player. I'm going to go and do some fan art of centaurs spooning. My name's DT.
Why is that the one that you chose?
Because I'm stuck on the idea of spooning now. How would they do it? Like, it would just be like mounting each other, but like on the ground, right?
I'm Red, White, and Snatch Alex, part-time librarian, Winnebago thief, inverse Batman, centaur biologist, bison basher, king killer dude, master and space commander, Molotov Donkey.
And I'm Seth. Bye, love you.